Support for IPR comes from Orchestra Iowa, presenting Pops on the River, an outdoor concert experience with songs from the Eagles featuring the Seven Bridges Band and the entire symphony. June 1st at McGrath Amphitheater. Tickets at orchestraiowa.com.
It's Talk of Iowa from IPR News. I'm Charity Nebbe. Name a scientific development from the last 50 years, and the odds are pretty good that Ira Flatow has covered it. You probably know him as the host of Science Friday, a show that he's been hosting since 1991, first for NPR, then for PRI, and now for WNYC Studios. And of course, it's on every Friday here on IPR. His career as a science journalist, though, goes back even farther than Science Friday. In fact, his first science stories were created in 1970 during the first Earth Day. Ira Flatow is coming to Iowa. He'll be chatting with IPR host Tony Sarabia at the Science Center of Iowa in Des Moines on Thursday, May 2nd at 6 p.m. And you can also buy tickets to attend Science Friday Live on Saturday, May 4th at 6 p.m. at C.Y. Stevens Auditorium in Ames. And Ira Flatow is with me now. Hello, Ira.
Hey, hello. Thank you for chatting with me. Nice to meet you again and nice to be on your radio show.
Well, it's wonderful to have you here. And I want to go back way to the beginning, your origin story as a journalist, because you studied to be an engineer at State University of New York at Buffalo, but you were working as a journalist while you were going to school. Where did this idea come from to be a journalist, even though you were studying engineering?
That's a good question. That shows you how good a student I was at engineering at the time. Actually, I was a very bad student at engineering. I always wanted to be an engineer, but when I found out what they do, I really wasn't crazy about it. I went on to get my degree. But while I was there, I said, you know, as an engineer, let me go over to the radio station they have at WBFO in Buffalo and twirl the dials a little bit. And when I got there, they were expanding the staff to hire more reporters because the Vietnam War anti-war movement was moving through Buffalo and they wanted reporters who would cover the demonstrations and the activities that were going on campus there. And so I learned how to cover riots after 1970, when Kent State happened in May. The university, our university, like many others, sort of closed the doors after all kinds of rioting went on here. But in the same year, we had the first Earth Day. And I said, well, maybe I can cover something else. I really like science. Maybe I can do some science reporting for Earth Day. And so 50-odd years ago on Earth Day was my first science story. And I happened to be in the right place at the right time because my boss, our program director and station manager named Bill Seemering, he left Buffalo to start NPR. He created All Things Considered, wrote the mission statement. And I said, Bill, it's cold here. Get me out of Buffalo. And so finally, eventually he agreed. And when I graduated that spring, and I hung around Buffalo until the fall, and Bill hired me the first year they went on the air. And so the door was open to do some more science.
So you came for the tech, but you stayed for the journalism. What got you hooked about telling stories?
Well, that's an interesting question. I didn't know I had any talent for telling stories until when I was in high school. I was one of these nerdy science kids with the pocket protector and the slide rule, if anybody knows what that is.
I'm shocked to learn this. Yes.
Yeah, I was. And so I remember in English class one day, Mrs. Kestenbaum, what a central casting name that is for an English teacher, we were reading Death of a Salesman. And she said, you know, you read that part so well. I actually got to read Willie Loman. She said, you ought to try out for the senior class play. And so I said, me? Little nerdy guy, me? She said, yeah, give it a shot. So actually I did, and I got the lead in the play. And so I sort of came out of my shell, and I've been talking out of my shell ever since. I sort of enjoyed it, I discovered. And that's how I discovered that I could be a storyteller and not be afraid to talk in front of a microphone.
When you went to NPR, being the science correspondent wasn't your first job, really. Was that something you ended up sort of carving out for yourself?
Yeah, actually, yes. When I went to NPR, Bill Siemering didn't want to hire another reporter because he had all these reporters, all these people he was hiring as entry-level jobs were getting on the radio. He said, I just hired somebody named Stamberg and another one named Wertheimer, and they come in as entry-level jobs, and the next thing you know, they're on the radio. You've got to be an entry-level position. I said, okay. So he introduced me to a staff of 35 then. They're now 835. And he said, this is Ira Flatow. He worked with me in Buffalo. He will never be on the radio. And I wanted to hide under whatever little table we had there. And then 3 days later, I was on the radio because I was a great baseball fan, and the Washington Senators at that time were bought by Texas, and they were moving to become the Texas Rangers. And they looked around for somebody who had reporting experience, which I had in Buffalo, and who loved baseball, and I was there. And for that day, I was back in the job as a reporter. And then I hung around a little longer and started producing science stories and got on the air as a science journalist and helped create the science unit that still exists at NPR.
So, obviously, NPR has evolved a great deal since then, but science journalism has also evolved a great deal since then. And you were really part of that evolution in bringing science stories to the general public, because there had been, you know, science publications. But do you really feel like science journalism was even a thing before you started
That's a very good question, because when I first started doing science back in the late 60s, early 70s, most of the science that people talked about and most of the science reporters covered space. Remember, yeah, we were in the middle of the Apollo moon missions. And so all those science reporters were going to Cape Canaveral and out to watch the blast-offs and things like that. And, you know, you had Apollo 11, you had Apollo 13. All those big events happened around that time. So when I became a science reporter, I started covering a little bit of space because it was at the beginning of my career, but I really wanted to cover other things like medicine and health, and having no background in any of that, I had to teach myself all of that. I mean, there was no genetic engineering when I started. It didn't start till like 1974, but by interviewing really top-notch scientists, they taught me, because they were so good at it, everything I needed to know about doing my job in those areas. And I also discovered that as a storyteller, I had to find ways of talking about science that were not conventional methods. But I remember one of the most popular stories ever done at NPR in those days was a story I did about wintergreen lifesavers sparking in the dark. And I got a letter from a mother who said, my kids go in a closet and chew wintergreen lifesavers. And that, you know, being a modern mother, I'm trying to stay away from asking them. They said, no, Mom, we do it because they spark in the dark. I had no idea why, and no one knew why. And I went in the closet with Susan Stamberg at the end of All Things Considered, and we sparked in the dark. And we got more mail from that for the next 10 years about the science, the physics of what happens when you crunch a sugar crystal and it sparks, and the wintergreen flavoring makes it green so you can see it. And
that story got a whole lot of play during NPR's 50th anniversary too. Yeah. You probably got mail about it over again. Tell me some of your thoughts about covering science in a way that is ethical and reaches the public and focuses on the science of the story as opposed to the politics of the story.
Yeah, it's very hard to avoid the politics of a lot of science stories. And we try to do that as much as possible. And we try to talk about the evidence. What does the evidence show? Because the evidence is really what science is about. You come up with an idea, and then you collect the data, the evidence to prove or disprove that idea, your hypothesis. But sometimes people have already made up their minds, and I learned very early on that if people make up their minds, it's very hard to change them because they may have a political bent, they may have a religious idea about it, and you're really not going to change their minds about something. And I remember, as you point out, in the early 90s, we were talking on one radio show about autism and vaccination. And I recall one show in particular where we had the world's expert on virology, who was a tremendously important person, sitting next to me in the studio with a whole bunch of papers disproving there was no connection, showing there was no connection between autism and vaccination. And I was taking calls on the radio, which I love to do on Science Friday, and that's why I created it. And a woman called in, and she said, I don't want to get my kids vaccinated, and I never will. And she went on for 8 straight minutes. She had a monologue, and she was very, very good at speaking. She was articulate. She made her points well. And I let her speak. I'm a great believer that you have to hear what everybody has to say. And when she was done, I asked her if she was finished. And she said she was. And I said, ma'am, can I ask you one question? What's that? Is there any amount of evidence in any form, in any way we can convey to you, you know, with this evidence to change your mind? And there was a pause, and she said, Ira, I just don't believe anything my government tells me. And how do you argue with that, right? You're really not going to change her mind until maybe there's a paradigm shift that happens. Like with climate change, I don't think anybody can deny climate change today like they did in the 90s and the turn of the century. But you just have to learn how to deal with that because it's very hard to change anybody's mind.
We're going to have to take a short break here. We will be back in just a moment. I am talking with Ira Flatow. He is the host of Science Friday, a job he's been doing since 1991. And he's bringing Science Friday to Iowa. He'll be here on May 2nd, chatting with Tony Sarabia at the Science Center of Iowa at 6 p.m. And you can attend Science Friday live on Saturday, May 4th at 6 p.m. at C.Y. Stevens Auditorium in Ames. This is Talk of Iowa from IPR News.
Support for IPR comes from Orchestra Iowa, presenting Pops on the River, an outdoor concert experience with songs from the Eagles featuring the Seven Bridges Band and the entire symphony. June 1st at McGrath Amphitheater. Tickets at orchestraiowa.com.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.
It's Talk of Iowa from IPR News. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, I am talking with Ira Flatow. He is the host of Science Friday, a show he's been hosting since 1991, first for NPR, then for PRI, now for WNYC Studios. He has also been a science reporter, for more than 50 years. Ira Flatow is coming to Iowa. He's bringing Science Friday. He'll be chatting with IPR host Tony Sarabia at the Science Center of Iowa in Des Moines on Thursday, May 2nd at 6 p.m. And you can buy tickets to attend Science Friday Live on Saturday, May 4th at 6 p.m. at C.Y. Stevens Auditorium in Ames. And before the break, Ira, we were talking really about the evolution of science reporting, but I want to talk about your career because 50 years of science journalism, and you have covered so many incredible breakthroughs, developments, and stories through all of those years. Give me some of your thoughts about what are some of the stories that really stand out to you?
Oh, you're right. So many of them. Going back to the 1970s, where I covered Three Mile Island. I spent 2 weeks at Three Mile Island covering the reactor meltdown out there. That was kind of scary, eating lunch in the station wagon with a Geiger counter hanging outside of the window. I've covered the space shuttle launches, and that was kind of exciting, and getting to know the astronauts. I've watched the evolution of genetic research. I mean, this whole idea is of we're able to create stem cells and watch how they work. The discovery of dark energy and dark matter in the universe, one of my favorite topics. Our microbiome, all the stuff that lives inside our body, all the bacteria and the viruses and whatever, trillions of them living inside our body that affect our health and our well-being. All kinds of things, from big to small, you know, tiny things to giant things. It's been a ride, and it's just, there is so much to cover that we have to, we have trouble deciding what to put on the radio every week. You know, there's a lot of stuff going on.
I remember an interview that you did with Francis Collins right after he decoded the human genome for the first time. In fact, we were trying to get an interview at the station that I worked at because he had connections in Michigan, and you got him first. So we were all sitting and listening with bated breath to that conversation. But I think of how decoding the human genome has transformed medicine, transformed our understanding of genetics in so many powerful ways. Do you think that is one of the most influential science developments that has taken place during your career?
Absolutely. Understanding the human genome and the genome of other animals that we experiment on, like mice or other kinds of animals, so we know how to do our experiments and what they mean. The human genome decoding, as you say, is really, really a huge breakthrough, as well as artificial intelligence now is in understanding medicine, because AI is allowing us to make great strides in health, in diagnosing diseases, just by looking at the test results instead of a person looking at it. When we put AI looking at your x-ray results or whatever, AI discovers so many more things that people don't discover, and that's another whole revolution waiting to happen.
I remember when you traveled to Antarctica. And again, of course, I think about all that we now understand about climate change and the changes that we've seen to our environment over the past decades. Tell me a little bit about your thoughts about that, about having the opportunity mm-hmm. to really be in that environment and then knowing what we know about climate change.
Yeah, it was a life-changing experience because to this day, even my kids wonder why I carry so much warm clothing in my trunk of my car.
Just in case.
But seriously, I mean, I remember going to Antarctica. This was in 1979. I got to go even to the South Pole. And when I was in Antarctica, there were researchers who were studying the ice pack there. You know, it's where there's more fresh water locked up in Antarctica than anywhere in the world, in the ice. And they were discussing, you know, at that time when I was there, whether we would have a cold snap. We were in an interglacial, a period in history between the glaciers. Was it going to get colder? People were thinking about that. But there was one guy who was, I think he was from Minnesota. I can't remember his name at the moment. And he was measuring the ice because he says, you know, it might actually get warmer. We might actually have a heat wave here. And I want to know if this ice melts. I want to be able to track it, so I need to have a base measurement of what is here now. So even in those days, there were some hints that, you know, we might have climate change and make it warmer instead of colder. But Antarctica, it was just a wonderful trip for me.
In thinking about communicating with the general public about science stories. I mean, earlier you were talking about how when someone is convinced of an idea, it's very hard to convince them otherwise, even if you present all of the evidence that there is. When we were talking about vaccines earlier, in the last 4 years, have really seen a disconnect with the pandemic between scientific understanding, scientific knowledge, and the reaction of the general public. And I remember a lot of people saying during the, you know, the most difficult part of the pandemic, saying that science literacy is really lacking in the general public. It's worse than ever before. I'm curious about your thoughts about that, because I wonder if science literacy in the general public has ever been better than it is now. What are your thoughts about that?
My thoughts about science literacy is that we don't teach it well in grade school. We don't teach science well in high school. We teach science, if you remember your science, chemistry, physics classes, you teach science, the way it's being taught is as if you're going to be a scientist. You conduct these experiments in class, you learn how to do these problems you're never going to see again. So you don't get an appreciation for what science is. Most people don't know what science is. They think it's an encyclopedia of knowledge, when in fact it's a method. It's a little photograph of our knowledge about nature at the present, to any present time. I mean, in high school, you may get they may have an art appreciation course, and you learn who all the great artists were, you know, how they did their artwork, what made them really famous. You may have a music appreciation course and learn who the great musicians are, why it's important to study music, the evolution of music and instruments. We don't have a science course like that. We don't ever teach anybody why science is important, how to appreciate it, who the great scientists were. Because most people, as I say, are not going to become scientists, but they're going to be asked to understand science later in life and vote on the monies that will go to science, and they don't actually really understand how it works. And I think that's a great shortcoming of our educational system, and that's something I would love to see change.
I'm talking with Ira Flatow. He is the host of Science Friday and has been since 1991. You have done a lot. I mean, obviously, Science Friday is, in many ways, a science appreciation course for people who choose to listen. But you've also really invested so much time and energy over the years in building Science Friday into being more than just a radio show, and in creating a lot of educational content that teachers and parents and kids can really tap into. This must be a real passion for you.
Yes, science education is a real passion for me. I was, my father always was very eager to, he didn't have very much money, but is always eager to buy me science toys and little gadgets and things and spend money on science projects. And we do explore every different way that we can reach the public in science, because, you know, science education is crucial to our well-being. Science dictates technology, and technology dictates jobs, and jobs are important for our economy. And what's at the root of all of this is scientific research. So we need to talk about research. We talk about it every week. We talk about it. Research that even may go nowhere. I mean, just science for the sake of doing science is worthwhile in itself. So we try to do that every way we can, in every medium we can, every possible way of reaching out to people.
In this day and age, I feel like you talk about maybe we don't do science education as well as we should. But a thing that worries me is I think it's important to teach children about climate change. But I feel like a lot of kids learn about climate change and learn about some of the really dangerous environmental crises that we're facing before they learn about the fundamentals of nature, before they really make a connection and develop a love for this environment that we want them to grow up wanting to protect. Does that concern you that maybe we are scaring kids before we're inspiring their awe and their love?
That's a very good point, because it's been my observation that all kids are natural scientists. They all grow up as little kids. They're running around the house. They're running around the backyard. They're looking at the things. They want to know how stuff works. They take it apart. They're really interested in being really natural little scientists. And somewhere along the line, usually it happens around adolescence when their minds focus on other things that adolescents do, they sort of get lost there. And, you know, they need some sort of person to help guide them through those tough periods of life. And it's usually a mentor. It was my eighth grade teacher, Mrs. Pfeffer, who had a science club after school. But if you talk to really successful scientists or people who stay interested in science, they had somebody else who helped them stay interested and took an interest in them. Because, as I say, everybody starts out as a very interested scientist, and we have to learn how to keep them interested in that. Because then they, you know, science is this joyful thing to know. And if you can get past that hump, you will be a lifelong learner like most of our audience is.
Do you have advice for parents?
Yeah, stop saying don't do that. Yeah, I mean, I'm a grandparent. I've had three grandchildren. I've had three kids. I know how easy it is to say, don't do that. You know, you have to find a way of channeling that don't do that reaction to, oh, cool, that's cool. How about trying it this way? You know, and when kids get curious about things, do it that way and take them to science museums. Take them on trips. You know, there's a research paper that shows that only 5% of what kids learn in their lifetime about science is learned in classrooms. Just 5%. 95% of what you learn about science happens on a field trip, happens in a science museum, at the planetarium, all those places. And so encourage and bring your kids to listen to the radio, to Science Friday. In fact, when we go on the road, we come to Ames, I'm telling you, when we open the microphones to the audience, a 9-year-old is going to beat you down the aisle to that microphone, and you're going to see how many kids are interested in science. They love it. But keep those interests going by taking them to science-related events.
You are going to be doing Science Friday Live on Saturday, May the 4th be with you, at 6 p.m. at C.Y. Stevens Auditorium in Ames. What's your plan for the show?
Oh, we have a whole bunch of stuff that we're going to talk about. And one of the things I always like to talk about on the radio, because it unites everybody. Everybody, no matter what your political bent is, everybody's got to eat. Right? So let's find subjects that have to do with agriculture. And what better place to do that than in Iowa? So we're bringing on experts to talk about many phases of agriculture. What is the future of agriculture using robotics and AI and giving farmers a better understanding of their crops? Because climate change is happening, right? How do we develop drought resistance? How do we develop crops that are compatible with climate change? Also, we're going to talk about nanovaccine. There's a nanovaccine institute at Iowa State University, and they're developing nanoparticle-based vaccines that you inhale, like a spray that can be delivered to your home, you know, making immunization really much easier. Also, we're going to talk about material science at the Ames National Laboratory. And my favorite thing I'm looking most forward to is there's the Midwest wine and grape and wine industry at Iowa State, and we're going to sample wine. I mean, I didn't know that Iowa is a burgeoning grape destination, that the folks in Iowa are growing lots of great grapes and lots of new wines, and I'm going to get a chance to sip some wine made from the Iowa State own research vineyard. I'm looking forward to that. So that'll be a lot of fun, a lot of good stuff.
That's coming up on May 4th, and we are selling tickets to that event, C.Y. Stevens Auditorium in Ames. You can find out more at ipr.org/events. And Ira, I want to ask you, you have had this incredible long career in public radio and in science journalism. You are 75 years old now. What keeps you going? Why? Are you on the radio every Friday at this point in your life?
Because I never grew up, right? I mean, I never lost that curiosity about how everything works. And I'm just a nerdy kid who loves to talk about science. And I will chew your ear off, as I'm doing now, about it. And because the truth is stranger than fiction a lot of times, especially in science. And I'm just curious about how it works. You know, we all want to know where we came from, where we're going, and the ride along the way. Theologians, philosophers, they all ask that question. And science is here to try to figure out how it all happens. And I'm just excited about it.
Well, there are more relaxing ways to feed your curiosity, but it sounds like broadcasting, bringing that to the public, does that still bring you a lot of joy?
I still love it. Yeah, I love talking with the audience. I mean, I talked about being on stage when I was in high school. I still love being on stage. You'll see when I come to visit you in Iowa and get on that stage, I will still love to talk to the audience because there's great feedback, and I like to hear the questions. The audience has the best questions, much better than anything I can say, especially the kids. They ask the darndest things and some of the simplest, hardest to answer questions. So I'm really looking forward to that.
Ira Flatow, thank you so much.
You're very welcome. And I'm so happy looking forward to coming to Iowa and seeing you all on Saturday.
Ira Flatow is coming to Iowa. He'll be chatting with IPR host Tony Sarabia at the Science Center of Iowa in Des Moines on Thursday, May 2nd at 6 p.m. And you have a chance to attend Science Friday Live Saturday, May 4th at 6 p.m. at C.Y. Stevens Auditorium in Ames. You can find out more at ipr.org/events. This is Talk of Iowa from IPR News.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.
It's an encore edition of Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe.
The other thing about this woods is there are other people that hunt it, so sometimes they beat you.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. And right now, I am at an undisclosed location in northeastern Johnson County. I am here to learn how to search for morel mushrooms. And the location is undisclosed because mushroom hunters are very reluctant to share their secrets. I have asked a master morel hunter to show me the ropes, Mark Vitosh. He is a forester with the Iowa Department of Natural Resources, but he is not on the clock right now. Mark, thanks for taking me out.
It's great to be in the woods.
So, we are on the land of someone that you know. You've, of course, asked permission to be on this land. That's a pretty important rule for mushroom hunters, right?
Yeah, it's a big rule. People yell about deer hunters and others, but sometimes mushroom hunters don't do so good in making sure that they ask for permission, knowing the property lines, make sure, because everybody wants to mushroom hunt, so they don't want you taking their mushrooms that they're going to be out there on Tuesday hunting. So yeah, just be respectful of people's property. Also, we always talk about invasive species and stuff. Clean your boots from one place to the next. Try not to carry things like garlic mustard and stuff like that. Clean your gear and all that kind of stuff before you walk on to different properties.
What makes this a good location to hunt for morels?
Well, it depends who you talk to, but if someone's gonna start mushroom hunting, I always like to tell them to kind of focus on elms. We'll talk about that a little bit, dead elms and this kind of stuff. But I would say any timber that has a diversity, even if there's not elms, sometimes there's just something about those woods. There's other trees, ash, oak, what I always tell people is start with the elms first, especially elms that have died freshly the year before. Those are the ones you want to focus on. And then once you start learning the woods, you might find other places that are just good places to find mushrooms, even though there may not be elms.
How long have you been hunting morels?
I've only been hunting morels, actually hunting, probably for about 18, 20 years, but my grandma Lois, God bless her soul, when I was a young kid, got me to start eating morels. She would get them from her friends, and she'd cook them up in that a black pan and put a little breadcrumb on them and cook them in butter, and I just fell in love with them. And no one else in my family likes to eat them, my folks or anyone like that, but I just always really liked them. And then thankfully my father-in-law, who I've been married to his daughter for 33, something like that, he picked them for a long time, and I always found a way to be there when he was cooking them so I could get a few. And now I've returned the favor. He can't get out in the woods anymore, and so my first bag went to him from my hunting last Saturday.
Nice. That's great. Well, okay, before we start looking, this is such a brief season every year. Some morel seasons are longer and better than others. But in a typical year, what are you looking for that tells you it's time to get out and hunt?
Well, especially in the woods, the May apples are starting to come up. The Dutchman's breeches are blooming. The marigolds are up. Some of those, you know, there are things starting to come up. There's not a lot of, even look now, there's not a lot of trees that are like leafed out, but they're starting to leaf. And then, like I've told the story before, I've been keeping a diary since about 2006. And about 5 years ago, looking at my records, I always noticed the first mushrooms I found were about the same time that my crab apple in my backyard started blooming. So I religiously now, I wait till that thing blooms, and it bloomed on May 2nd, started to bloom, and then I think I went 2 or 3 days later and found 35 little grays on this one specific hill that I always go to first where I find. And the other thing is, usually we go to south and west facing first part of the season, and as it gets a little longer, then you start moving to the east and the north because those are cooler, longer, and a lot of times you may have a lot of vegetation on the south and west and there's nothing on the north yet at all. Usually if there's no vegetation, it's too early to hunt mushrooms.
I know a lot of people look at the oak trees. I've heard that when the oak leaves are the size of a mouse's ear, that's when you should start looking for morels. Not your cue.
I've heard a mouse's ear or a squirrel's ear, whichever. Yeah. Somewhere in between, maybe. but I have really focused on the plants. Like the May apples aren't in bloom, but usually their canopy is up when I start finding them. And then usually before it's over, they're in bloom too. The other thing for me, just historically, if and this year is very unique, if I'm still hunting in Mother's Day, it's been a long season or it was very cold. So this year it was very cold, and I started like 3 or 4 days before Mother's Day, and that's just doesn't happen very often.
Almost unheard of. So you mentioned little grays. You hear people talk about little grays and then the big yellows. So tell me what the difference is.
Well, I believe there's actually a species difference between the two, and I'm not going to throw scientific names at you. But the grays tend, and there can be bigger grays, but the grays have a gray color, and the yellows are much more yellowish. But the mushroom itself, a lot of times on the yellows, the membrane is just thinner, and the grays are usually really thick, and I love the grays. They're juicier, and I love mushrooms, so I'll eat yellows too, but I mean, I just like the grays. Now, the grays can be pretty tiny. I found some the size of my pinky nail the other day, so I mean, and I sat there probably for 5 minutes before my eye actually found it, you know, so they're tougher. The other challenge is this time of year is there's, like in this forest, there's a lot of oak and hickory leaf litter, and sometimes there's mushrooms there and you just don't see them.
That's why you carry a stick,
That's
right?
why I carry a stick.
All right.
But so, I don't go out and rake areas or anything like that. I mean, I used to be really focused on finding everything when I was a little younger. Now I just like to be out and I focus on certain trees, and if I miss some, hey, I miss some.
All right. Well, let's start looking. Tell me
Tell me what you do when you start to look around.
So the thing that I actually do when I'm mushroom hunting is I'm always looking forward. I'm looking maybe 20 to 35 yards ahead of me. And again, I tend to focus when I hunt a lot of these areas, I look for dead elms. And obviously this time of year, we're seeing a little green in this woodland. So I can usually tell, being a forester, I can tell by the branch structure and stuff. And a lot of times I can tell if they're dead. But the thing that I focus on is I go after elms that probably died last year, where the bark is really tight. And you might see that the woodpeckers are starting to work on it, but it's not really sloughing. Now, I will stop at the ones that are sloughing too. But from my experience, usually the ones that have tight bark that died the year before, if they're going to produce mushrooms, usually their highest production will be that first year. And then a lot of times I'll go by in year two, there'll still be some. And then I went by one on Saturday, it was year three. And if I go year three and still find some good mushrooms, I call that the giving tree. Now, if the bark's sloughing, a lot of times, if there's some bark on the bottom still and it's sloughing on top, I might walk by and just take a glance because you never know. And then the other thing is you may just have, again, like I said earlier, you may have an area that is just a good mushroom site. It could be year five or six and no more elms there. The area where I find my grays when my crabapple blooms, there hasn't been a dead elm in there for 8 years. But it's every year I find 10 to 30 little mushrooms on this one south-facing hill. And there's just something about that hill that produces a few grays.
All right. Well, I'll follow you.
Okay.
I'm being careful, but I didn't bring a stick. So I see you looking up, and that's to check and see if there's foliage on the trees, right?
Right. So this is a dead elm, but it's probably been dead for a couple years.
Because I can see the bark sloughing.
Right, right. And so I'll just take a quick look around, and I usually stop. You know, the one mistake I think people run into is they go right to the trunk of the tree. And like the other day when we found some, we probably found them 10 to 15 feet from the trunk. You got to remember that it's association with the root systems, and some of those roots can go a long way. So I usually stop a ways out and kind of work my way in towards the tree. And you know, it's kind of like fishing. You got to wait till they bite. They always say you find the first mushroom and it'll usually give up the rest. So it's just a matter of giving it some time and just taking a deep look. And because again, if here there's a lot of debris on the ground and stuff, and they could be hiding. But again, since this has been dead for a couple years, I wouldn't expect to find much.
Right. But when you stop and look,
yep.
Tell me what you're doing with your eyes. You're sweeping the ground. What are you looking for?
So I'm looking for a sponge. In my mind, my eye sees a sponge. It sees sponge texture because that's what a mushroom, what a morel is. So it's that gray or yellow. Now, that's the one thing that a lot of people like about the yellows is they can get awful large. They're more that yellow color, that blend, that there's a contrast with that in the green. So sometimes it's easier to find those than the grays. Because here, if we look down, there's a lot of brown.
Everything's gray.
Everything's gray. So it tends to blend a lot, and it's pretty hard to find them. And that's it. That's where patience. And I was telling you on the ride out here, this for me, this is not work in the sense that in my normal job, I'm looking at woodlands, looking at characteristics of trees, and looking at the conditions. And when I'm doing this, I'm not thinking about that most of the time. Once in a while I do, but I'm just thinking about walking in the woods and seeing mushrooms.
It's a mental break.
Yes, yes.
I see some dead elms over there.
Yes.
People that are new to mushroom hunting,
uh-huh,
getting really nervous about finding the wrong thing.
Right.
Do you find false morels?
I do, but the one that's actually a false morel, that is identified as false morel, doesn't look anything like morel. Mm. It's kind of an orangish, really large and kind of gelatinous looking. But then there are some others, and we actually saw some Saturday, that have really kind of pointed tops, and they have a very long stem, and they don't have as much sponge look as the true morel. So there are some out there. The other thing is, you know, Iowa State has a great publication. I think it's on foraging. And then they have one, I think, specifically on mushrooms, and it has like colors of pans, like red, doney, green, okay, yellow, you're on your own kind of thing. But, you know, those things are good too. But I think I would always go starting with somebody that's got good knowledge that you trust, and always follow up with the challenge with pictures, like we know with tree ID and all that kind of stuff. There's so many different characteristics. Sometimes you still may miss something.
All right. Yeah. So do your homework, but also ask an expert.
Yeah.
So one of the things that makes this so addictive is that it's hard, right?
Yeah, it's not easy. I mean, some days it's easy, but a lot of days it takes time. I mean, we're not going to do it, but we could spend 3 hours in here today looking every little corner trying to find, you know. I mean, the challenge too is you're focusing on ones that die, and if you have a woods and they start, a lot of them die, that may reduce, you know. I walk with people and they're like, well, 10 years ago this was great, and then you see all the skeletons of all the elms and you know why it was great, and now they don't have as many left, so they're just not finding as many.
Do you have some morel hunting superstitions?
One of the superstitions is I don't take my bag out of my little pouch here until I find the first mushroom, which it hasn't come out because we haven't found any. I told you I was afraid with the little bit of dryness and different things that maybe we weren't going to find any today, but we'll keep taking a look and see what we find.
Bringing somebody with a microphone along might be bad luck too.
It's all good. It's always a lucky day when I can walk in the woods. Let's put it that way.
Oh, hey, Mark. I found some morel mushrooms.
Nice.
Two little ones are what I can see.
See, it doesn't take much to make you happy when you're out mushrooming.
No.
It doesn't take much.
No, it's exciting.
It is.
So what's your favorite way to eat them?
So my favorite way to eat them is I like Ritz crackers, and I actually like the Ritz crackers that have vegetable mix in them, and then just cook them in butter. Yeah,
nice.
And brown them up just right, and they're good. And then I usually will try to eat them within 3 days. Try to eat them or give them away. My favorite part is I've got 4 or 5 people that I know really appreciate them. So if I can get 1 or 2 plates and also give them, you know, a bag or two through the season, that's a great season for me.
Mark Vitosh, thank you so much.
Thank you. I'm glad we finally found some.
Me too.
All right.
We were walking the woods and hiking the hills, hoping to find some sweet morels, and we hung all day long.
This segment of Talk of Iowa was produced in May of 2022 by Matt Alvarez. And this is The Morel Song by Iowa musicians Chip Albright and Jason Wallsmith Storyteller. This is Talk of Iowa from IPR News.
Sweet smells of morels, you bring me peace. With memories of times so sweet and swell. Oh, sweet morels. Then out through the thicket, we saw the light flashing on a fun guy.